loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we discuss President Erdogan of Turkey's speech about the assassination, the killing of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, and the implications for Saudi-Turkish relations, Turkish-American relations, and what comes next. And then it's Tuesday, so we continue our weekly series, False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, we'll talk about how the lottery works, why it's so high, and who this affects. Next, thousands of migrants attempting to escape poverty and violence have made it into Mexico and are heading north towards the United States. As this human drama plays out, Donald Trump and the Republican Party are seeking to exploit the situation for their electoral advantage. Then, the U.S. Cyber Command announced that it is targeting Russian operatives, claiming this is an effort to deter them from influencing the U.S. midterm elections. The cyber cold war is heating up. And then, Chinese President Xi Jinping yesterday opened the world's largest bridge 9 years after construction began. The 34-mile-long span will connect Hong Kong to Macau to the Chinese mainland and is supposed to enhance economic growth in the region, but the corporate media in the West is treating it like an act of aggression. And finally, we're 14 short days away from midterm elections, and in many states, early voting is already breaking records. Most of those states are in the South, where early voting is up between 100 and 1,000%, and according to the Cook Political Report, it's Republicans who seem to be flocking to the polls. And in other headlines, President Trump is calling for a buildup of the U.S. nuclear arsenal. Speaking to reporters on the subject of the United States' intention to withdraw from the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, Trump said, "Until people come to their senses, we will build it up," referring to the U.S. nuclear arsenal. This comes despite a $1 trillion nuclear weapons modernization program initiated by his predecessor Barack Obama. A retrial started today of a U.S. Border Patrol agent in the 2012 cross-border killing of 16-year-old Jose Rodriguez. The boy was shot at least 10 times, mostly from behind, and he was unarmed. Others were throwing rocks across the wall when the accused Border Patrol agent, Lonnie Swartz, began shooting and then reloaded and kept shooting. The Border Patrol is claiming it was self-defense. Investigators inspected an explosive device found outside billionaire George Soros' home in his mailbox today. George Soros funds the organization Open Society Foundations, a grant-making organization, and provides resources to many groups worldwide. Soros is frequently the target of criticism from the far right wing. Sandra Day O'Connor announced today that she has been diagnosed with dementia and as a result has withdrawn from public life. She retired from the U.S. Supreme Court in 2006 after being the first female judge appointed to the court in 1981. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the ongoing saga with the murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Turkish President Erdogan said today that the Turkish government had strong and convincing evidence that Khashoggi was killed in, quote, a premeditated and savage murder, close quote, at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. He also called for Saudi Arabia to extradite the 15 Saudis implicated in the case for trial in Turkey. Meanwhile, Turkish officials say they have found the journalist's body and it's buried in the garden of the Saudi Consul General's house. We're joined from Tehran by Mohammed Mirande. He is an expert on American studies and post-colonial literature who teaches at the University of Tehran. Mohammed, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you for having me again.
Yeah, it's our pleasure. In this segment, Mohammed, we want to focus, again, we have breaking news. Khashoggi's body was discovered.
Apparently was discovered in the garden of the Saudi Consul General's home. It had been chopped up, dismembered, and his face was mutilated. That's being reported by Sky News in the UK.
So we want to talk about those grotesque and gruesome details. We also want to talk about what the Turkish government, what Erdogan is really doing here. Of course, he's saying that the murder of the journalist, you know, laid heavy on his heart. Okay, but there must be other parts of the Turkish-Saudi relationship, which is complicated, which in fact are at play and perhaps being negotiated on behind the scenes. We want to talk about some of those issues as well. Anyway, let's first start with the latest news and Erdogan's speech today. Your reactions?
Well, it was a very interesting speech. Some were saying that it was disappointing because he didn't reveal a great deal of new information, but some believe that it was actually a very effective and important speech. The fact that he said that the 18 people have to be interrogated in Turkey and that this was beyond some Fall Guy. He also directed himself to King Salman and ignored MBS. So it's, you know, it's difficult to say at this stage because we don't know what goes on behind the scenes, but some friends seem to believe that there may be negotiations for some form of compensation on behalf of the Saudis. But some others who I also consider to be credible in Turkey, friends in Turkey, believe that President Erdogan wants to get rid of Mohammed bin Salman. So it's hard to say, but the speech was important in that he stressed that he didn't believe that these scapegoats were the real figures behind the murder, and he stressed that it was premeditated.
And why the focus on Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, the real power, or seemingly was the real power in Saudi Arabia? I mean, outside of culpability and being able to credibly link this murder to him and the incredulousness of not linking it to him. Aside from that, is there something about Mohammed bin Salman's leadership and the policies pursued under his leadership by Saudi Arabia that have become the focus of the growing or the deepening contradiction between Turkey and Saudi Arabia?
Yes, I think it's really important to keep in mind that Mohammed bin Salman is very central to Kushner's or Trump's so-called deal of the century. He is allegedly supposed to put pressure on the Palestinians so that they will relinquish their rights as an independent nation. Some believe that the recent move to prevent Palestinian refugees in Lebanon from getting visas to go to pilgrimage, that this is somehow linked to that broader deal. I don't know, but he is very close to the Israelis, to Kushner, and to Trump on this, and also he supported the coup, the Saudi regime. On the night of the coup in Turkey, their media was very hostile towards the Erdogan government. They were basically celebrating the overthrow of the elected government in Turkey. And only 16 hours after the coup was declared as defeated, did the Saudis come out with a statement saying that they support the legitimate government in Turkey. And of course, the Emiratis are just as hateful towards the Turkish government. There have been emails that have been leaked showing their role in antagonizing Turkey and in their support for the coup, emails that apparently the Qatari government helped to discover. So there is a great deal of antagonism and hostility. And then again, the alliance between the Turkish government, the Brotherhood, Qatar, the Saudis supported the coup in Egypt. And all these together, all these combined, and their hostility towards the Muslim Brotherhood and the Emirati hostility towards the Muslim Brotherhood, all these combined have created a huge antagonism between the two sides. And one thing that has not been discussed much in the media is that during the last couple of weeks, as the Turkish media has been very effective in tearing apart MBS, the Saudi and Emirati media have been attacking Turkey relentlessly, especially for the first couple of weeks.
I wanted to ask you too, Mohammed, if you could comment a little bit on Turkey's relationship with Qatar. The Saudis and the Qataris hate each other with a special kind of passion that's usually reserved for these Middle Eastern states, to the point where they've actually exchanged fire over the border. The Saudis have actively tried to overthrow the young Emir of Qatar. And the Qataris and the Turks have established a very close, a very warm relationship. The Qataris have invested billions of dollars in the Turkish economy, in Turkish infrastructure. And it seems to me that this tripartite relationship must be playing a role in Erdogan's response to Khashoggi's killing.
Yes, well, Qatar has been supporting the Muslim Brotherhood, especially after the so-called Arab Spring or the Awakening that we saw in 2011. And this was an issue which caused conflict with Saudi Arabia and the Emirates. But on the other, especially because the Saudis and the Emirates were supporting the reactionary despotic regimes across the board. The only place where they did align themselves, unfortunately, sadly, the Saudis, the Emiratis, the Qataris, and Turkey, was in supporting extremists in Syria. ISIS was funded by all of these regimes. They aligned themselves in trying to overthrow the Syrian government. And that was a point of unity between these countries or these governments. But gradually, as the Syrian government began to regain territory and other issues began to, other issues were more important, but the tensions between Qatar and Saudi Arabia and the Emirates began to increase. The cracks between the two sides, meaning the Turks and the Emiratis on the one hand, the Turks and the Qataris on the one hand and the Saudis and the Emiratis on the other, they began to increase. There was a fallout, and that was earlier, and that was managed. But then again, then later on, we had another fallout, which led to this siege, this ridiculous siege by Saudi Arabia and its allied small regimes like the Emiratis and Bahrain, which are really very insignificant in themselves. But the siege, which continues until today, has been a huge point of friction between the Saudis and Turkey, because the Turkeys have put forces into Qatar to protect them against any Saudi incursion.
I wanted to ask you another question, too. Gina Haspel, the new director of the CIA, has arrived in Istanbul for talks there and in Ankara with the leaders of the TINIO, the Turkish National Intelligence Organization. What do you think they're discussing? And why would she go there rather than to Riyadh?
Well, I think that it's possible. It's possible that she wants to learn the new methods of torture, that she has a lot of experience herself.
That's my line.
But that aside, I think that the Americans, the Trump administration, is looking for a way out, because obviously the Trumps desperately want to keep Mohammed bin Salman in power. They want to continue. They want to be seen as being effective in their policies in this region, and Saudi Arabia is central to those policies. If when it comes to Syria, when it comes to the peace of the deal of the century, and when it comes to U.S. policy on Iran, Saudi oil wealth and Saudi oil production is key. So if Mohammed bin Salman loses power, if the Saudi Arabia is weakened, and I think that Saudi Arabia has already been significantly weakened as a result of the recent events and previous events as well, that is a major concern for Trump. And Trump is both concerned about his image because of his close relationship with MBS, and he is concerned about his effectiveness in his regional policy. So she's probably there, in my opinion, to encourage Turkey to come to some sort of deal with the Saudis so that MBS could stay in power and he can continue with his policies. But my colleagues in Turkey, they seem to believe at the moment, and I have my friends who are somewhat well informed and honest people, They may be wrong, but they seem to believe that President Erdogan is in no mood to cut a deal with the Saudis.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Very interesting and very important. There's so many different elements of, and again, I would say for American audiences, a lot of, because of unfamiliarity, people not really understanding, even like what the, you know, if the Saudi government is an Islamicist government supporting Islamicist Wahhabi supported forces.
Yep.
Erdogan and the Qataris supporting the Muslim Brotherhood. I think people in the United States won't know the difference. I mean, unless they're Muslims or familiar with Middle Eastern politics, perhaps. So, you know, I'd like to try to unravel some of that, sort of just to give our audience, maybe they're turning on the radio today here at 4 o'clock on 105.5 FM or 1390 AM and try to make heads and tails out of this. But the and the other thing I'd like to ask you, Mohammed, is, of course, for Erdogan in Syria, the big issue, it's not the only issue, but perhaps the biggest issue is what happens with the Kurds, what happens with the YPG. The United States has been functioning with them, supporting them, in many ways using them as a proxy. And at the same time, the Turks want both the United States and the Saudis to stop supporting the Kurds in Syria to the extent that they do. How big of a factor is this in terms of Erdogan's negotiating position? So perhaps on both those fronts, if you don't mind.
Okay, I'll try to be short. First, I think that Erdogan in this broader, let's say, framework, he has a strong hand to play with. Therefore, when it comes to the Kurdish issue, it's going to be the Americans and the Saudis who are in a weaker position. Obviously, what happened in Istanbul changes many things in the Saudi-American-Turkish relationship. So it's a changed situation. It's a very changed situation now from a few weeks ago, and I think that Erdogan will use that to his benefit in the near future. But with regards to Islam, I would say that Wahhabism was a very obscure sect, has nothing to do with mainstream Islam. It was in an area called Najd in what is now called Saudi Arabia. And it only became powerful because of the rise of the Saud family and the discovery of oil and U.S. support. So Wahhabism is a product of oil wealth, a despotic family, but also U.S. support. And therefore, the extremism that we see is not so much, has nothing to do with mainstream Islam. It has to do with geopolitics and the U.S. role in this region. 40 years ago, Wahhabism had very, very little, if any, influence in Afghanistan and Pakistan. The different sects, Muslim sects and minorities, were living together without major difficulty, and in many areas with absolutely no problem at all. But this sectarianism, which the Americans and the Saudis used in their conflict with the Soviet Union, and also to contain the Iranian Revolution, because the Iranian Revolution had a huge impact in countries which were client regimes, despotic, and controlled by Western powers, especially the United States. So the Saudis, in order to contain the Iranians, as well as in the struggle against the Soviet Union, expanded their madrasas and made Wahhabism a very powerful force because of the sheer amount of the money that they spent in these schools and in these mosques that were basically Saudi and very different from the indigenous culture of Pakistan and Afghanistan. Ultimately, that led to 9/11, the rise of the Taliban, 9/11. Remember, the only two countries in the world that officially recognized the Taliban government were the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia. These were the only two countries in the world that recognized it. The Americans had no problem with these two client regimes and their relationship with the Taliban. Again, later on, these extremists were used in Syria and in Libya and so on. With regards to the Muslim Brotherhood, I think that's a very complicated story. And I don't think we have enough time for that. But what I would say is that the mistake that the Muslim Brotherhood made in Egypt aside, their alliance with Saudi Arabia, including in Syria, and their alliance with extremism and extremist forces pushed trends within the Muslim Brotherhood towards Wahhabism, towards extremism.
Interesting.
And therefore, segments of the Muslim Brotherhood have become very sectarian and very brutal, as we saw in Syria, very similar to ISIS and Al-Qaeda. But other segments of the Muslim Brotherhood are not sectarian at all. And they are, as we see in many parts of Turkey, my own friends who are in the Muslim Brotherhood or affiliated to the Muslim Brotherhood in Turkey, they are not sectarian at all. They have no hostility towards other religions, other sects. So the Muslim Brotherhood isn't a monolith. It isn't a single entity. But Wahhabism on the whole, which goes back to Muhammad bin Abdul Wahhab, is a very big problem, but it is a construct, or it is an ideology that has been strengthened and brought out of obscurity by the United States and the Saudi regime.
Mohammed Mirandi is our guest. Mohammed talks to us from Tehran, Iran. He is an expert on American studies and post-colonial literature. He teaches at the University of Tehran. So we have the CIA director, Gina Haspel, in Turkey. We have the Turkish government, Erdogan, saying that he was going to reveal everything today. He didn't reveal everything.
No.
But certainly he used the pulpit, so to speak, to maintain a lot of pressure both on the Saudi royal family and on the United States. We have, as Mohammed pointed out, the Jared Kushner and Trump, the Trump White House basically, working on the so-called deal of the century, which is basically to extinguish the flame of Palestinian existence, not simply the rights and of the Palestinian people. The so-called deal of the century, a dream of the far-right Zionist forces, both in Israel and those in the U.S. who are backing the Trump administration. They are relying on Mohammed bin Salman to help make that happen. Of course, they need a partner in the Arab world and a well-resourced partner if such a thing were to happen, and I don't think it can happen, but certainly that's what they're trying to do. This is a complicated, very complex, multifaceted sort of crisis that's developed, Mohammed. You said to us yesterday, you said, well, what world leader would want to stand with Mohammed bin Salman right now for a photo op? And the answer probably would be none. And you also speculated that without knowing the timetable, that this would, in fact, be the beginning of the end of Mohammed bin Salman. Now, it's only been 24 hours since we talked, but upon reflection, do you feel the same way? Do you feel anything has changed in this rapidly evolving situation and as a consequence of what's going on in Turkey and between Turkey and the United States?
Well, I think that the United States will do whatever it can to preserve Mohammed bin Salman. And he, of course, will fight for his survival as well. He's a despot and a very powerful person with enormous resources. And the United Arab Emirates and the United States and the Israelis are supporting him. But I think that the damage done to Mohammed bin Salman is too great for him to be able to recover. And therefore, I think that he is no longer the Mohammed bin Salman of 3 weeks ago. He no longer has that sort of power. He's a diminished figure. And I think that the same is true to a degree with the whole Saudi regime. Whether he lasts for weeks or months or more than a year or two, that I don't know, but I don't think that he can recover from this. I do think that a lot depends on what the Turks reveal in the coming days. They've done a very excellent job in gradually leaking material and keeping this whole affair on the front pages of newspapers and the top news on websites and social media. Of course, I think that there's also another agenda, and that is that opponents of Trump in the United States are using this to hit Trump because of MBS's relationship with Kushner and Trump himself. But that aside, I think that the Turks, if they continue to reveal new information, that will hurt MBS even more. And Saudi Arabia is a very fragile country. It doesn't have a civil society. It doesn't have a constitution. It doesn't have any checks and balances. It's sort of like Libya. It's dependent upon a very small center. In Libya, when Gaddafi was murdered, the country fell apart. Saudi Arabia is not a country like Iran or Turkey or France or Britain or Japan or the United States. It is named after a family. And that family right now has been sort of sidelined, and it's basically one person now. So that makes it very fragile, and therefore the stability of the country is something that could easily be damaged.
An amazingly fast developing story, and Mohamed Morandi is right. The way the Turkish government has let this come out drip, 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 has kept it front and center, and of course different political forces are at play who want to keep it front and center. We've been joined from Tehran by Mohamed Morandi. He is an expert on American studies and post-colonial literature. Mohamed teaches at the University of Tehran. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We have a lot more. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Today we continue our weekly series. It's every Tuesday, called False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. We're joined from San Francisco by Daniel Sankey. He is a financial policy analyst. Daniel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's talk about the U.S. stock market. It's going down.
A lot.
It's been going down. Anyway, go ahead, Daniel. What's our first story?
Yeah, so our first story is about the U.S. stock market, which this morning plunged a tremendous amount, about 400 points on the Dow when last I looked. No, actually closer to 500, excuse me. So this is something that is continuing into this week. It happened last week as well when there was extreme volatility and it dropped hundreds of points over the period of about 2 days before kind of bouncing back. And so what we're seeing right now is a lot of instability and uncertainty. And really, that is around a number of things. It's really around the tariffs against China, which are causing our economy no small amount of chaos. Really, tariffs are huge, broad-sweeping economic changes that are imposed by a state. And it's never totally clear exactly how they're going to shake out and exactly how they're going to impact things. And so all the different investors and different companies are kind of waiting on bated breath to see exactly how it will shake out and trying to predict what will happen. So this morning, Caterpillar, 3M, which are two big industrial giants that produce construction equipment, amongst many other things, reported poor earnings, basically. And that was largely due to the tariffs, which had increased the cost of a lot of output inputs on them that they need to assemble their machinery. These, giants kind of impact the economy in a larger way because construction is heavily dependent on them. So if they're doing well, it means there's a lot of construction and a lot of development going on, which provides jobs as well as a lot of economic growth. And if they're doing poorly, the inverse is typically the case. So what we're seeing right now is the kind of typical instability and kind of boom-bust cycles, albeit on a smaller scale in a capitalist economy, because of all the uncertainty that is produced when you have an economy that is essentially kind of anarchistic and produces at the whims of a few small groups of people as opposed to for what a society needs. And so the inevitable instability of that system is what we're seeing this morning, especially.
I should just say, John, that we're recording this segment at 12:20 p.m. East Coast time. We're talking to Daniel from San Francisco. So this morning, the stocks have dropped significantly. They've come up a little bit in the last little bit. Stocks just broke below a key level, and what's next could decide the fate of a bull market. This is, I'm looking at CNBC, Daniel. The S&P 500 fell below 2,710. Its recent October low and now a major test zone as the market looks for a bottom. A close below that level would be bearish, but if the market bounces and closes above that level, it would be seen as positive. However, if the market stays weak and goes lower, investors will watch for the new zones it could retest. The thing that gets me in these kind of discussions about the stock market is depending on whether the stock market goes up, continues to go up, or whether it goes down precipitously, so much rides on it. Because even though the majority of working people may not own stocks, if this casino called the stock market goes way, way down, it's going to have an impact on the real economy. People are going to lose their jobs. Many people will start to lose their homes. Again, it's a crapshoot. And I'm saying crapshoot, not using a curse term, but this is like a gambling term. It really is a gamble.
It is.
It's speculative money in the stock market. But because we are told that this is just the way economies function, which isn't true, this is the way this economy functions, that people just have to accept their fate, even though they're not part of the stock market, they're not profiting from the stock market in the main. But if it goes down, which eventually it will, then working people bear the burden of that. That's the nature of our economic system.
That's the nature of it. And that's why it's always the case that it's the small investor, it's the person who can afford it the least, who gets hurt the most.
Yes, that's absolutely the case. I mean, this volatility makes a tremendous amount of money for very wealthy people. There's very wealthy firms and hedge funds that bet against and on this sort of volatility and make a lot of money off of it. And so who doesn't make money, though, is a small-time investor, is, someone who maybe has a 401k that they put money into, or someone that's trying to make a little extra on a pension fund, right? I have a good friend whose pension fund was wiped out, about half of its value was wiped out during the 2008 crisis. And she did the right thing, right? She put money into her pension fund. She listened to all the kind of talking heads and the pundits that says, oh, this is the right thing to do. This is, a good economic decision, or putting money in your 401k. Hey, this is, socking some away for the future when you'll retire or whatever, and you have extra money. And, the proverbial wisdom is this is a smart thing to do. But the truth is, it is a crapshoot. She lost half of her value because of 2008, and it never really bounced back. They were never able to really recover it. She shouldn't have put any money in her pension fund. She should have, put it in gold and buried it in the ground or hid it somewhere. But the truth is that because of this kind of roulette style betting against the stock market, average everyday people lose a tremendous amount of money and are put significantly at risk. Hedge funds can lose their money, right? They can go bust or take a loss or whatever, and the people's lives are not materially impacted. They'll walk away still fantastically rich. Average working people can't. They can't gamble with their savings that way. They need it to survive. They need it for their future. And this sort of typical boom bust instability puts them at risk. Who actually likes it, though, and I mentioned it before, though, are the investment firms that do these short-term bets, these short-term loans, these derivatives and options on these little price fluctuations and volatility. And when the stock market takes big hits like this, or big dives, or big bounces up, they make a lot of money off it. But average folks like us can't usually get access to those financial instruments, certainly can't risk losing all of our money on it the way hedge funds can, and really don't get access to the opportunity to really profit like that. That's really for the multimillionaires and the multibillionaires.
Daniel Sankey is our guest. We talk to Daniel every Tuesday in this segment called False Profits, a look at corporate capitalism. We're talking about the continued downward trend of the stock market. Donald Trump, John Kiriakou, sort of owned the stock market politically as it went up because he claimed credit for it.
By his own choice, yeah. He claimed credit.
That might be short-sighted. Because,
I think so.
Because if it's his doing, well, maybe Donald Trump will say it went up because of him, but it went down because, I don't know, migrants are coming from Honduras,
right?
Or
the Democrats won't let him pass stronger laws,
or Brett Kavanaugh was upset. There's some other reason why the stock market will go down, but nonetheless, he will actually own it because he's made such a big deal out of it.
Well, he was taking credit for economic growth still under Barack Obama's final budget, and so yeah, he made a conscious decision to own this economy. He's been, of course, crowing about the historically low unemployment that we're seeing, although we've talked about that on this show, that it's not really as low as everybody says it is. But if he's going to claim credit for the stock market going up, he's going to have to take the blame for the stock market going down. And because it's cyclical, it's inevitable that it will go down.
Yeah.
It always does.
And Daniel, although we were sort of being sarcastic about blaming migrants from Honduras for the decline in the stock market, because of course Donald Trump and the Republicans and others have been using immigrants from Central America and from Mexico as a punching bag, even though we made a sort of a sarcastic reference to it, what Trump will really do is blame the Federal Reserve, because the Federal Reserve has been raising interest rates from where they were, which was zero. And he's angry and he's upset. And there's been all this talk in the media that this is an unprecedented interference by a political leader into the wonderful sort of, I don't know, sanitized, isolated, pristine environment of the Federal Reserve, made up, of course, of the biggest bankers in the world. I'm looking at Paul Volcker, who was the Federal Reserve chief in 1979, and who says right now that the economy is in a hell of a mess, in his words. He was talking, and I'm going to read to you about how Ronald Reagan tried to interfere and did interfere with the work of the so-called independent Federal Reserve back in the 1980s, showing again that this is normal and not something completely new and different. Here it is. Volcker also dispels with the myth that presidents historically haven't tried to influence interest rates, recounting a 1984 meeting he had with former President Ronald Reagan. Then Chief of Staff James Baker flatly told Volcker, "The president is ordering you not to raise interest rates before the election." I was stunned, Volcker said. Anyway, Volcker has, this is an account with Volcker. It's a CNBC interview. Let's talk about that. Again, Donald Trump, it's attributed that Donald Trump has done something really unusual, but according to the former Federal Reserve Chair, Paul Volcker, again, a person who deliberately took the country into a recession, costing millions of workers their jobs, he says, no, that's the norm.
Yeah, I think it's really important to talk about the role of the Fed. You mentioned, you know, that the popular media is sort of saying, oh, it's a sanitized sort of objective decision makers in this non-political institution, which is ridiculous. The Fed is an extremely political institution and has extreme political power. So first, we just need to acknowledge that it can push the economy around, that its statements carry tremendous weight and move trillions of dollars across the world. It is a political machine. Now, typically when presidents have sought to influence it, they want to have the perception that they're not directly influencing it, that they're not demanding things from it, because that's an unpopular thing. They want to preserve the illusion that it's somehow, you know, this objective, apolitical machine. I think one of the things that Reagan was talking about and Trump are both pointing out is that these interest rates create these huge artificial bubbles. And both Reagan and Trump want these artificial bubbles to stay intact until after the elections, because of course, if they burst shortly before the elections, that's all everyone's going to be thinking about. And that will, of course, really hurt them in the election terms. People will blame the bubble bursting on them. So they got to keep it inflated. So let me unpack that a little bit. As a way of trying to get us out of the 2008 crisis, the stock market, of course, was collapsing, and the value of all these different financial instruments were crashing through the floor. And there was a number of things that they did to prop them back up, to sort of save, you know, global capitalism at the time and push it back up. And one of the things they did was lower interest rates to practically nothing. Now, why that matters is many investors see U.S. treasuries as a very safe bet, because the U.S. economy is considered the greatest in the world, the most powerful, the most stable. Investing in treasuries is a very safe investment. Your money is going to make a little profit and you'll be fine. But if you lower the interest rates to zero, those U.S. treasuries that you're investing in, you make virtually no money on them. In fact, you make practically zero. And so even though it's a safe bet, no investors want to put money in it, because you don't make any money. So what's the point? So what they do instead is they take their money and they put it in the stock market. And that causes the stock market to inflate artificially. It doesn't inflate because it's producing items or services that people want and need, and therefore selling and creating growth. It inflates simply because people are dumping all this excess money into these different firms. So the firms suddenly have a whole bunch of extra money, and the price naturally just goes up. So when the Fed raises the interest rate, now investors are saying, oh, hey, there's money to be made over there. I'm going to take my investments out of these more volatile stocks, as we've seen today. The stocks can be very volatile, and put them in treasuries, which is causing the stocks to tumble down and causing their value to crash. And so what Trump is trying to do is trying to pressure and bully the Treasury into not doing that until the elections are over, because he knows what an incredible bubble all this is. He knows how incredibly overinflated these asset prices are, how the value isn't really there, how Tesla stock and all the others aren't really worth what they're supposedly worth. But he wants to keep it going until after the election. And then once the election's over, who cares? You know, we can let it go to hell, and, you know, the voters won't have an opportunity to make any decision at that point. And that's really the dynamic we're seeing.
What a risky strategy that is it not? I mean, I would rather, if I were the president, I would rather run the risk of losing one or both houses of Congress than forestalling an economic disaster for 2 years and then risk losing the presidency. But I think what you're saying, Daniel, is exactly right. I think that's what we're seeing here. He just doesn't want to see an economic downturn take place in the next 2 weeks. And if it happens in the next 3 weeks, then he doesn't so much care.
That's exactly right. And Reagan was the same way. And, you know, many presidents before them are the same way. Their voting and their success and their, you know, election cycle is heavily tied to the economy. And that's the fastest thing voters will respond to, is they see a downturn, they start worrying about their jobs, they start worrying about their income. They're going to start thinking, this last guy, he put me in trouble here. Let's get him out. Or this last party, you know, if it's the GOP, they're causing all these troubles, we're going to get him out. So that's really what it's doing. It's, you know, it's not healthy. It doesn't take workers into consideration. It doesn't take Americans into consideration, where they're trying to create an economy that produces the best jobs for them, the best opportunities. It's purely politically opportunistic. Which is what we're seeing here. It's a very cynical way of running a campaign, but it is so typical in Washington. This is a very typical way of trying to kind of manipulate election cycles and secure seats, you know, in the Senate.
Yeah, and you can see how this plays out in numerous ways. And because political and social reality is complex, we can't always be fully predictive on how things are going to play. But there are some things that are considered foundational. One of them is the state of the economy in general, in a macro sense, but also for individual workers or for individual industries also. I mean, you take a look at Trump's tariffs on foreign steel. That's allowed the U.S. steel company, for instance, to jack up its prices. Its profits have gone through the roof. The steel workers were not seeing that because the contract that was being offered by the U.S. Steel to the United Steel workers was a bad contract, a concessionary contract. The workers just authorized a strike, and as a consequence, they got a good contract. I talked to people associated with the union over the weekend. The contract was considered very good because they even think the Trump administration may have leaned on U.S. Steel because they want to placate workers because they want them to vote for the Republicans in the November election. So the United Steelworkers, which is historically maybe, well, certainly a majority Democratic voting union, probably right now, according to the person I talked to, who again is an official in the Steelworkers Union, thinks that 60% of the steelworkers, again, traditional Democratic voters, will vote for Trump or vote for the Republicans if they think it's a referendum on Trump. And yet, if the economy tanks because of the trade war with China, if that's the tipping point and everything blows up right before the election, what people are going to be remembering is the specter of another major great recession. And yes, so we have it play out in all of these different myriad ways. Bottom line is that the capitalist economic system has its own laws, its own sort of dynamic function. And the politicians can only do so much. So when things are going good, they say, look, that's because of my policies. And when it's going bad, that's because somebody else has done something wrong. Workers in America need to have an independent, a class orientation that sort of cuts through the demagogy of the Republicans and the Democrats. And their unions need to do the same. Otherwise, they end up just being the tail at the end of somebody's kite. And that somebody is usually a demagogue. Anyway, Daniel Sankey, let's go on to the next story.
Yeah, definitely. So the next story was published in Bloomberg, and it's entitled "The Student Loan Debt Crisis is About to Get Worse." The kind of headline then goes on to say the next generation of graduates will include more borrowers who may never be able to repay. So I know we've mentioned this. We talked about the student loan debt crisis months ago and a number of times on the show. And I wanted to raise it again because it's kind of coming up again, where what we're seeing is a generation of students who probably will never be able to pay back their student loan debts, that the kind of regulatory apparatus around it has allowed them to take out loans far larger than they're able to repay, has allowed interest rates to accrue in really unhealthy ways, has allowed students to pay less than the interest rate so that the loan actually grows over time in spite of the fact that they're paying for it. And what that's created is, and it's going to create a new generation of people who will permanently be in debt to student loan companies, to the banks, essentially. It also goes on to talk about the kind of cost of education and how the kind of continuing push to privatize education is naturally causing cost to increase in education, which necessitates more loans to be taken out. Combine that with the fact that the last 10 years, working people really have seen no real wage gains, that it was kind of a lost decade because of 2008. So it makes it even harder for parents to, you know, pay for their kids' education or to help them out, whereas they traditionally would. And really what we're seeing is the kind of making of a new economic crisis. The size of student loan debt is now $1.5 trillion, which is an insane amount of money. People are being allowed to take out loans that they can never pay back. Regulations are such that they actually grow in size instead of reduce. All this to me sounds a lot like 2008 and sounds a lot like what we were doing with the mortgage crisis, where mortgage loans were considered these very safe investments that were, you know, quote, safe as houses, right, that could never fall apart and that were just a guaranteed return. And student loans in many ways were portrayed in the same way because they had government backing and government support and intervention. I personally think that this is a kind of powder keg waiting to explode, where students, you know, the next time there's an economic downturn, and there will always be an economic downturn, these students aren't going to be able to pay back these loans. And once the money stops coming in, then we're going to really start seeing how much is actually in the bank accounts of these large banks. And what we'll find is they just have these huge liabilities on student loan debt as opposed to actual wealth.
$1.5 trillion in student debt?
That's correct.
$1.5 trillion.
That's right. $1.5 trillion.
When you mentioned that number, I just looked at the list of countries of the world in their gross national product. So every country, starting with the 15th country, that would be Mexico is 15th, Indonesia 16th, Turkey 17th, Netherlands 18th, and all the way down the list for the next 100 till you get to 190, the gross national product of those countries is less than American students owe in student debt. That's how big student debt is. And student debt, by the way, is for bankers, because ultimately the service, the interest, and the service on that interest, meaning the profits that go to the lender, that's for the banks.
Yeah.
So students are bailing out bankers.
Students,
imagine. Young people, young workers. And after they graduate, they can't get jobs to pay back the student loan. And of course, as we've talked about, there's only one kind of debt in America that you can't declare bankruptcy on and thus escape, and that would be student debt. So you'll go to your grave with it. Anyway, go ahead, Daniel. Let's go to the next story.
So one of the next stories that I wanted to talk about was that there's this new economic zones, these opportunity zones, are being created throughout the U.S., and it's a process of passing through legislation. And really, what this legislation does, just in a nutshell to keep it simple, is it provides huge tax breaks to developers, to, you know, private equity firms that build housing for low-income areas. So what it does is allows these developers to build in these low-income areas, and because they get huge tax breaks and tax benefits to develop there, they're heavily incentivized to build in them. And the ideas are called opportunity zones, which is this real kind of euphemism. Because really, when I read this article and I go through it, what I see is this is an economic incentive to continue to gentrify low-income and affordable areas, where this is really a push to get these large funds to build, you know, luxury condos or higher-end housing, housing essentially that people in that community can't afford. And it's always a little bit of a risk normally, because those hedge funds and those equity firms, they want to make money off of this. And so they're a little skittish, because if the community can't afford it, then what's the point of building it? But now they get these huge tax breaks. So now they're getting tax breaks to gentrify areas, to build not so affordable housing in there, because of course it's profit driven, right? So they want to build as nice a housing as they can to attract the, you know, wealthy people of the area. And this will continue to help push along gentrification. So what this does is it allows them to roll over taxes that they normally have to pay on those buildings for several years. And in fact, they can even defer them longer if they keep their investments in that area for 10 years. So this is something that the Treasury is pushing forward. It's all but, you know, passed at this point. It also allows them to get tax breaks if they build 70% in these supposedly economic opportunity areas. If the 30% is then in high income areas, they'll still get the tax breaks overall because they're considered to have been investing, you know, enough in low income areas. And really, to me, I just see this as legislation to continue this kind of push of gentrification, which is really gripping all major urban centers now and causing, you know, tremendous poverty and homelessness in these areas as working people are getting pushed out, unable to afford housing in those areas anymore.
This is going to be an issue too in other cities across the country, I think, especially if the measure passes. And I think it will pass, even though there are big companies like Lyft and Uber, for example, that are against it. But I think that that people seeking affordable housing in places like Washington, D.C. or New York or elsewhere along the East and West Coasts are going to look to this as an example of what they can do in their own locales.
Yeah, I think it's certainly possible. And I think it just goes to say, you know, these equity firms make so much money.
Oh, it's crazy.
Real estate is so tremendously profitable. The rents are insanely high, which means the profits are insanely high. And what we've decided to do is, no, that's not enough. We need to give them more tax breaks so that they can continue to, you know, profit here. And, you know, this is very consistent with this current administration. It's not that surprising. You know, bailing out and giving tax breaks to the ultra wealthy seems to be the name of the game. And that's what we're seeing more here. That they need more incentive to gentrify areas and build more luxury condos so they can continue this kind of, you know, insane real estate market.
That's the voice of Daniel Sankey. Daniel joins Loud and Clear every Tuesday in this segment called False Profits, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism. Daniel is a financial policy analyst. He's talking to us today, as he does every week, from the San Francisco Bay Area. We have a few minutes left, Daniel. Where do we want to go next?
So one of the things I think that would be good to talk about is Bloomberg had an article entitled U.S. Labor Markets Aren't Truly Free. And in a nutshell, what it talked about is how historically workers have had a lot of opportunity to go to different jobs or move between different companies within their particular sector. But what it talks about is the looming monopolies in our economy, for example, Amazon, and how these huge monopolies are really also monopolizing the job market. And what that means is workers in towns where the only real jobs are provided by a small handful of companies have even less and less opportunity to move between companies, to quit jobs they don't like, to try to get better jobs, to try to get better pay. Because, you know, when Amazon's the only game in town, where else are you going to go? And what this does is gives huge outsized power to these monopolies, which allows them to really drive down wages. Because if you're the only game in town, well, you're going to have a stack of resumes on your desk and you can just kind of pick and choose. You can easily fire people because you can hire someone new. You can give, you know, really terrible wages, terrible raises or really low wages. And the point is, you're the only game in town. You don't have to compete with anyone. And so the article really goes on to show how the growth of these monopolies like Google and Apple and Amazon are really driving down workers' wages and really making it that much harder for them to, you know, attain a decent standard of living and a decent life because of their total dominance over certain industries, actually multiple industries, really.
Daniel, right now, the Trump administration has said the problem for American workers is China. China's taking advantage. China's, you know, reduced the stature of the U.S. economy, has many other complaints. I'm looking at a Wall Street Journal article. We only have about 2.5 minutes left. And I was really struck by it today. It says Dyson plans to build electric cars in Singapore. The British company said the manufacturing site should be completed by 2020 with sales beginning the following year. And it's just a reminder that these Western capitalist corporations that are doing business, they did it in China. Now, even in China, the wages are not low enough because China's economic program has actually led to rising incomes and increasing wages. They'll go somewhere else. The process of outsourcing a buy capital that's free, that's what's, maybe labor markets aren't free, but capital is free to go wherever they can maximize profit, largely by reducing the amount that they pay workers in the form of wages. this is the real dynamic in America's economy or the British economy or the other economies where the industrial workforce and big parts of the working class have been hollowed out. And it has nothing to do with other countries, quote, taking advantage or manipulating America or the UK. It's about where capitalist companies can make the biggest profits. I mean, that's the real deal.
That's absolutely right. I mean, we act like China's, you know, somehow abusing the largest economy in the world with the largest military in the world as if somehow they can do that. But the truth is the Dysons and the Amazons and the Apples and all these mostly U.S., although obviously some European as well, companies are happy to outsource. And the truth is, you know, capital moves freely. Capital moves easily with low tariffs and simple regulations. They can move their money wherever they like, open up factories wherever they feel like it. But workers aren't, because workers live in communities and workers live in a society. And we can't just all pack up and move to Singapore and get a job at the new Dyson factory. We are stopped at the border. We have to go through complicated processes to immigrate. We have to pay, you know, additional taxes. Then we have to leave after a short period of time because we're not a true citizen. All sorts of barriers are put up between us. And yet somehow, this is supposed to protect us. This is supposed to keep America safer. Really, that's the dynamic. Labor is not free to move. Labor is not free to, you know, seek better lives. But capital is extremely free, extremely flexible. And it's no surprise that when that's the dynamic, workers are the ones that lose in the long run. And workers are the ones that are, you know, forced into these monopolies and working for these companies that, you know, just have total power.
And as we have the media and Trump and the Republicans demonizing the thousands of immigrants who are migrants who are marching through Central America and to Mexico, meanwhile, capital flows freely into these countries to super exploit the same workers, depriving them, many of them, of actually being able to live, and thus they move. And yet they're demonized while capital flows freely. I mean, that's the discordancy in the world today. And that's the thing that has to be paid attention to. We were joined from San Francisco by Daniel Sankey. He joins us every Tuesday in this segment called False Profits, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.